This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It is our episode of Law and Behold, and we are talking about the death penalty today. So the Malaysian government is seeking to scrap the mandatory death penalty for 11 serious offences under the Penal Code, including murder and the Firearms Increased Penalties Act. But many civil society groups, including Amnesty International and Suhakam, for example, they're adamant that the abolition of the death penalty must be absolute, stressing that the right to life is guaranteed in the federal constitution. So joining me to discuss this very, well, rather polarizing topic are Emeritus Professor Dato' Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, who is a Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Sherry Razak Dali, who is a lawyer and also a filmmaker whose film Menunggu Masa touches on the death penalty. Welcome, both of you. How are you today?
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. So maybe to get started, we can talk a little bit about capital punishment in Malaysia. I mean, can you tell me a little bit about the history of that?
Well, the exact years may not be known to us, but from the first day of Merdeka, we've had death penalty available because our penal code actually is a British-drawn document that came to us through India. And death penalty in earlier era was always regarded as part of the criminology system. So we have always had death penalty, but what is significant is that over the years, the number of offences for which the death penalty or the mandatory death penalty is possible to impose has increased. Just to give one example, drugs at one time was a death penalty offence, but the judge had discretion. Mm-hmm. But then in the 70s, they change that to a mandatory death sentence under 39B. So the trend, in one line, just to say, the trend is towards increasing the number of offences for which there is death penalty. However, in all fairness to the present government, in the last 1.5 years, they have not hanged anyone.
Okay.
Under the death penalty laws. There is review going on. There is a very high-powered committee headed by retired Chief Justice Tan Sri Richard Malanjan on this issue.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong. There are about 17 death penalty offences, and 9 of these carry with them the mandatory death sentence. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, that's correct. Actually, your listeners may want to know very, very quickly, waging war against the Yang di Pertuanagong, offences against the person of the Yang di Pertuanagong or sultans or governor, terrorist acts, mutiny, murder, abetment of suicide of child or insane person, attempt to murder while under a life sentence, kidnapping or abduction in order to murder, hostage taking resulting in death, rape resulting in death, gang robbery with murder, trafficking in dangerous drugs, discharging a firearm in the commission of an offence, being an accomplice in case of discharge of firearm, offences in security areas. This has been repealed because the ISA has been repealed.
That's right. Mm.
Consorting with a person carrying or having possession of arms in a security area, this has been repealed. And abduction or wrongful confinement for ransom. So these are the major. I just wanted to clarify, the number 17 is not fully agreed upon because some offences like terrorism are covered by several sections.
Mm-hmm.
So whether those sections should count separate or as one. Nevertheless, there's a very large number of offences for which there is death penalty in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I think you've said before that, you know, some of the 17 offences, let's stick to that stat, right? They are very political in nature.
Well, yes, mutiny, waging or attempting to wage war or abetting the waging of war against the Yang di Pertuanagong. Surely these are offences with a political nature. And I personally think we should not be hanging people for political offences because much depends on who is in power.
Exactly.
Any time there is an attempt at change of regime, if it succeeds, then you are the saviour. If it fails, then you are actually guilty of mutiny or guilty of treason.
That's right.
So I think we should not be hanging people for political offences.
Sherry, would you have any sort of current stats for us about, you know, how many convicts that we do currently have, you know, sitting on death row?
Currently, as June 2019, there are 1,291 convicts on death row. 44% are foreigners, 70% of the sentences are for drug-related offences under Section 39B of the Dangerous Drugs Act 1952. 25% for murder, 2% for kidnapping with murder, and 2% for firearms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, that's. I mean, that whole thing about, you know, 44% of them being foreigners, that's quite a high percentage, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and that's quite worrying. Okay.
And it causes a lot of diplomatic tiffs because sometimes you have a foreigner, a tourist arrested for drugs, and in that country, drugs is either not an offence or not a serious offence. And quite often, actually, the head of the state from there will write to our head of state asking for leniency.
That's right.
And if we refuse, it causes a diplomatic tiff.
Mm-hmm. And I think we, Malaysia, we've written to other countries as well for our Malaysians on death row, for example, in Singapore.
Singapore, yes.
That's right. So talk to me about this mandatory death sentence, right? So that does that mean that the judge has no choice but to order death sentence, regardless of how they may feel, you know, about the outcome of that
case?
Yes,
that's the impact of a mandatory death penalty, where judges are not free to decide on punishment but are forced to apply the prescribed punishment as stipulated by the law, such as cases in drug cases and murder. Death sentence must be imposed upon conviction.
Okay.
Yeah, I have something to say about this mandatory from the constitutional law point of view, if you don't mind.
Of course.
We all know there's a doctrine of separation of powers. So the judicial function must belong to the judiciary. But if Parliament passes mandatory sentences, then basically what is happening is this. The judge tries the case. The judge makes the decision, judicial decision, that there is guilt or innocence. Mm-hmm. But once the judge has made the decision that there is guilt, conviction is determined. The penalty is not determined by the judge.
That's right.
It's determined by Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So I think mandatory death sentences are in some respects a violation of the doctrine of separation of powers. And may I just give one example where quite clearly it would be justice done in such a way that, you know, no one in his right mind would want to support it. Let's say, God forbid, a woman has been raped.
Mm-hmm.
She reports to the police. The police do their investigation, but either it was a perfect crime or there are some other factors. The accused is very high up, or there is corruption. And so no one is prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
This lady now is still seething. She's still hurting. Because unlike physical pain, emotional pains don't go away. So she waits. She waits. And then when nothing is done, she gets a gun. She goes up to his office and says, "Do you recognize me?" And she pumps a few bullets in his heart. Now that's under our law.
Murder.
That's murder.
Yes.
Because it's premeditated. It was not in self-defense because the law of private defense actually requires that it must be immediacy.
Mm-hmm.
So it is murder. And if it is murder, there is only one penalty, mandatory death. Now, surely there is something seriously wrong with the legal system that would give mandatory death sentence to a woman who was raped, who did not take the law in her own hands initially, who reported, who waited, who suffered, who agonized. But then ultimately, when the law slept, she decided to do something. I know she deserves some punishment for killing someone, but surely not mandatory death sentence. So these mandatory penalties really are very, very unsound. They're a violation of separation of powers. They are an exception to the doctrine of independence of the judiciary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just going on the Constitution bit, what I mentioned earlier, it's stressed in the federal Constitution that the right to life is guaranteed. So, I mean, how do we sort of reconcile that in that sense?
Well, there is a right to life, but it also says, I'm sorry to mention to you, says, no person shall be deprived of life or liberty, save in accordance with law. So as long as there is a law, life and liberty can be deprived. Now, there is some hope here. At one time, our judges were of the opinion that the word law means any law whatsoever. Mm-hmm. In other words, if Parliament has passed the law, so be it. But now, in one decision at least, in 2019, the federal court said the word law does not mean any law whatsoever. It must be a law that is proportionate. So we have a totally new, exciting jurisprudence now, and that is this, that when Article 5, Clause 1 says, no person shall be deprived of life or liberty save in accordance with law, the law cannot mean just any law that a political majority passes, sometimes for political purposes.
Yeah, of course.
It must be a law that is not harsh, that is not unreasonable, that is not cruel or oppressive. It must be proportionate. So that would be my answer, that today now, the judiciary has the power to examine the proportionality of laws.
The law, yes.
Oh, that's a tricky
exciting
one.
I think what's the name of the case is Alam Nuda Atenza.
Yeah.
Alam Nuda Atenza. It's a case involving drugs. Mm-hmm. Number of Filipinas were arrested and number of assumptions apply. If you have possession, that means you have knowledge.
Mm.
And if you have possession plus knowledge, that means you are a drug trafficker.
Yes.
That means there is a mandatory death sentence. So the court said, no, this double presumption is unconstitutional.
Mm. That's a tricky one. I'm speaking today to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shahd Salim Farooqi. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya. And also to Sherry Razadali. She's a lawyer and a filmmaker. And we're discussing the death penalty in Malaysia. Is it still relevant? And we're going to continue that discussion after this quick break. You are listening to Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. And I'm Juliet Jacobs. It is our Law and Behold series. And today we're discussing whether the death penalty in Malaysia is still relevant with Emeritus Professor Dr. Shahd Salim Farooqi, who is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and also with Sherry Razadali, who is a lawyer and a filmmaker. And we're going to talk a little bit about your film after this, Menunggu Masa,
sure,
which talks about the death penalty and how it can be, there's a lot to it.
Problematic, you know, too.
Problematic is the word I'm looking for. So before we get into that, maybe let's talk about the arguments that are in favor of retaining the death penalty. I mean, of course, it is, like I said, this is a very contentious issue. You know, there's opinions on both sides. But let's talk about why people are in favor of retaining it.
All right. I will give the arguments that are being, that are coming forward. These are not necessarily my views.
Mm-hmm.
First argument in favor of retaining the death penalty is that our present law is quite in line with Article 6, Clause 2 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, 1966, which recognizes the inherent right to life. But it says that death penalty must be imposed only for the most serious crimes.
Mm.
The international law says there must be a right of appeal, which we have. There must be a right to apply for pardon. We have that. The death sentence should not be imposed on pregnant women and those below 18. So in that respect, what needs to be said is that international law as it stands today does not totally forbid death penalty. It allows it for the most serious crimes. Mm-hmm. Though, of course, the trend is moving the other way. But this is also international law. So we satisfy the above requirement of international law. Secondly, please bear in mind, we are not alone. 71 other countries, including the USA, mm-hmm, and China, Iran, Saudi, Singapore, retain the use of the death penalty. Then there's this popular argument, the death penalty is just retribution.
Mm.
Many people whose family members have been cruelly taken away, they say that if there are some moral monsters in society, who these moral monsters are unable to control their savagery or their violence, then society has a right to take revenge against them. Mm-hmm. So many people say fair retribution. Retribution is not unjust, provided the accused is given due process, etc. Then there is a further argument that, religious argument that life is sacred. God gives, only God should take it away. Mm-hmm. The rebuttal to that by the proponents of the death penalty is that reverence for life is not an absolute principle. Mm-hmm. Anywhere in the legal system, actually, there are exceptions. There are exceptions, for example, in relation to the law on private defense. Mm-hmm. Private defense allows us even to take life, to protect our life or to protect our property. Our property also.
That's right.
To protect our property, we can take someone's life. Mm-hmm. But of course, the right to private defense must be exercised in the immediacy of the situation. Then some legal systems, especially in Europe, allow euthanasia.
Yes.
Mercy killing. Mm-hmm. Though that's a very complicated topic. Euthanasia can be active, passive, etc. Then most countries allow abortion. Malaysia allows abortion, Section 312 of the Penal Code. Most countries allow police powers that permit the extinguishing of life in certain circumstances. The Charter of the UN, and this is very sad indeed, the Charter of the UN permits wars of self-defense. Now, everyone will agree that wars extinguish lives by the thousands, by the millions sometimes. Then even in religion, though killing is generally frowned upon, in some circumstances, the extinguishing of life is allowed in many religions, if not all. And finally, there is the economic dimension. Some people say if you incarcerate, if you detain a person for life, that means, Shari, it means 30 years, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
30 years. Or for his natural life,
until
that means as long as he's alive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you detain a person like that, you'll have to support him, you'll have to feed him. At the moment, it costs 35 ringgit per day to support a prisoner in prison. And the total bill for taxpayers for running prisons is over 1 billion ringgit per year. So some people say there'll be adverse consequences for the nation of removing the death penalty and increasing the prison population, which Sherry pointed out earlier. We've got 1,291 convicts on death row.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, the taxpayer has to pay for their upkeep.
And of course the argument is, why should I pay?
Why should I pay for someone who has committed heinous offences?
Okay.
So these are the major arguments.
Okay. And I guess, you know, some of the most common or cogent arguments against capital punishment is that, you know, sooner or later, innocent people are going to get killed because, of course, mistakes and flaws happen in the justice system. So
yes.
Maybe, Sherry, you can walk us through, you know, the arguments, you know, against the arguments against the death penalty.
Because for many, to understand how the legal system works, the legal system is to me, is an imperfect justice system. Mistakes could happen. There's disadvantages in the process from appointment of lawyers, understanding the law, understanding the criminal legal system, or having judges who would understand or go through the facts, access to evidence, information. So that's the real problem. So our risk is always in the legal system is you could convict innocent persons. That possibility exists.
That's right.
But many on death row are usually marginalized, poor, not highly educated. So they don't have the experience or the means to have access to those information or being able to present their case the best way they could.
Mm-hmm.
So they will not be able, for example, to understand the difference between the prosecution case or the defense case, at what stage should they present their case
mm-hmm.
at, which we have highlighted, for example, in our documentary film, Menunggu Masa, with the case of Maiten. Right? He has exhausted his legal means
mm-hmm.
Up until the review stage, even with having new evidence, for example, the the victim, the only person at the crime scene, which turned up 10 years later. And despite with that new evidence, the federal court refused to open back the case. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the disadvantages that we have in our legal system.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe, you know, for those who don't know that case, you know, maybe you could help explain what exactly happened, you know, and why there was such a... It was such a clear example of, you know, human error or complete disregard for evidence.
Okay. So what happened was Maiten was accused of murder with three other persons. And at the High Court, he claimed that he did not commit any murder. He assaulted this person by the name Devadas. And he was the only person at the crime scene assaulted that night. Mm-hmm. But they couldn't get Devadas as a witness during the trial. He disappeared. So the High Court in the judgment even said that Devadas' evidence was a fictional. Devadas is a fictional character. He doesn't exist and is an afterthought. Mm-hmm. But then he appealed at the Court of Appeal, at the Federal Court. They still couldn't locate Devadas even after the first review. But then Devadas turned up during Maiten's mother's funeral, and he agreed to assist and they filed the second review with this new evidence. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, despite this big evidence, the court didn't allow the review application. So now Maiten is stuck with in the legal system, waiting for execution. His only option now is the pardons board, waiting for answer from the pardons board. And that's what we're trying to highlight in our documentary film, Menunggu Masa, which you can Google Menunggu Masa documentary and then watch it yourself. And that's where we are trying to show and have that discussion with the public about our legal system and about the imperfect justice system, especially when we discuss the death penalty specifically.
And that also, you know, our justice system can be, I suppose, politically influenced.
Yes.
At the detriment of, you know, those who are caught up in the system.
Yes. Even the review application was heard in 2017. But there's even with new evidence such as that, the police didn't open back the case. Nothing much was done, you know. But if you compare to a recent case with the Altan Tuya, with the statue decoration, the police immediately then, you know, say that they will open back the case. So the treatment is different because of the personalities that involve and how high profile the case is compared to Maiten, which, you know, probably nobody to the society, a regular person. But that's the disadvantage that many of us on the streets face. Mm-hmm. You could be in the wrong place, wrong time, and be accused of something that you didn't do, but you don't have the access or knowledge how to defend yourself or have the ability to appoint a lawyer or present your evidence or know how to present your evidence to tell who the witnesses are, what evidence is crucial, you know. So many, many people on the streets don't have that access and knowledge.
That's right.
And where we're trying to also educate and advocate the public about knowing their rights. So it's a long process.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's not something that we see only in Malaysia, right? For example, in the US, where the death penalty still stands, people on death row are predominantly African-American, for example, according to some of the statistics, right? Even though in terms of population, they are still a very low number. But so it's something that we see that, you know, the poor, the disadvantaged, they tend to be the ones who are who might not have the access to the best lawyers or who don't have the correct legal knowledge.
Can I just add, interestingly, I read yesterday, actually, three men from Baltimore were wrongly convicted for murder for 36 years. Oh, gosh. And another recent one was South Korean man who was exonerated after he has been executed more than 70 years ago, and he was wrongly convicted. And in 2009, the government of South Korea Truth Panel found 438 civilian unjustly convicted. So throughout, not even just in Malaysia, everywhere around the world, there are cases. But for Malaysia, whether the enforcement or police or the judiciary are willing to review some of these cases and see whether these people are wrongly convicted. Mm-hmm. You know, that requires time, funding, and effort. So it should be we are disadvantaged to that because we don't have that means mm-hmm. to provide to actually review all these cases to probably see whether was there any wrongly convicted individuals who are now languishing in prison.
Mm-hmm. I think the issue here is that whole mandatory death sentence upon them, right? I mean, yes. Regardless of what happens, it's a death sentence on them, right? Whether yeah. and who's going to take up their case, for yes. example. So, I mean, does this mean we need a reform of the law? Is that the way forward?
Yeah, of course. We need several reforms in the law. First of all, I think the mandatory death penalty should go. The judge should have discretion to take note of extenuating circumstances. I personally know of judges who have expressed great remorse that they had to sentence someone to death because he or she confessed. Mm-hmm. The police put forward the evidence, the person confessed. Now, what can the judge do?
That's right.
Even though the judge, deep down in his heart, knew that there were some extenuating factors. Mm-hmm. A mother protecting her child. Mm-hmm. There have been cases like that. So I think mandatory death penalty often ties the hands of judges, and some of them have expressed despair that they have no choice but to impose the death penalty. Of course, there is the possibility of a pardon, but not that many people are pardoned, yes. and the pardon process itself is quite lengthy. So I think that's one. We should do away with all mandatory sentences. Even if there is death penalty, the judge should have discretion. Secondly, we must do away with presumptions. In the drug law, there are a number of crushing presumptions. Mm. If you rent your premise to me, mm-hmm. Actually it's your premise and my premise, we could both be held liable if things are found there.
That's right.
So there are some presumptions under the Drugs Act, very crushing ones. A person in the care or management of a premise is deemed to be occupier of the premise. A person in possession of 15 grams of heroin or morphine, 1,000 grams of opium, 200 grams of cannabis, specified amounts of other drugs, shall be presumed to be a trafficker. Mm-hmm. So the amount sometimes is quite small. And I'm told that these khatum leaves also yes. actually are, can you believe that? This is, in the kampong, these were used as a drink. The burden of proof is now on the accused, mm-hmm. not on the public prosecutor. Now, these presumptions are an exception to the rule in common law. And for that matter, in religion, in Islam, that everyone is innocent till proven guilty. A third thing that needs to be done is, even if we have to maintain the death penalty for the most serious or heinous offences, I think the number of offences should be narrowed down. Right now, we have too many offences. I personally think death penalty for political offences, even for an offence like murder, I have some reservations. You know why? Because a large number of murders are between people who know each other. Husband and wife, parents and children, brothers and sisters. Sometimes these are crimes of passion. Mm-hmm. They are not necessarily evil people. Basically, they lost control. So I think death penalty must be narrowed down. Then the death penalty cases must, in my view, be tried by a panel of three judges. We're putting the burden on one lone judge at the High Court. The law is very good. The trial won't be at the Sessions Court or at the Magistrates Court. It will be at the High Court. But still at the High Court, one judge sits. I think there should be a split panel of three judges. Each death sentence must be reviewed by the Pardons Board. And then there is this issue that has been raised. Not everyone will agree with it. In the Islamic system, there is the concept of diya.
Okay.
It's spelled diya or diyat, D-I-Y-A-H or D-I-Y-A-T. Basically, what happens is this. If the victim's family is prepared to forgive and the violator, the criminal, gives compensation, then the death penalty can be excused. So the law of crime then becomes the law of tort.
Interesting.
Compensation. At the moment, actually, if I commit a murder and I'm to be hanged, the family of the murdered doesn't gain anything except perhaps the satisfaction that the evil me will not be around. But in the system of diyat, it's an alternative to the death penalty, and it only applies when the victim's family agrees to compromise with the guilty party for a compensation. Tan Sri Chad Malanjan's committee heard this suggestion and they are considering. So I think with these reforms, a better balance can be achieved between the many conflicting perspectives with which this debate has been enriched. I just want to add that I'm very grateful, actually, that Sherry has pointed out that the criminal justice system is not foolproof, that there is a definite danger of fallibility. And sadly, it is finality as well, not just fallibility, but finality. And you correctly pointed out that the death penalty seems to be the fundamental right of the poor, the marginalized, and the minorities. At one time in the USA, rape was a death penalty offense. When a white man raped a black woman, invariably he got imprisonment. When a black man raped a white woman, invariably he got the death penalty. There's statistics.
Yeah.
You correctly pointed out, one can look at the death row. It's the minorities that suffer most. And may I just add, I'm sure Sherry will agree, but not other lawyers. Sometime when a lawyer is appointed by the court to represent an unrepresented accused, there may well not be the best defense made available, unlike if there was a rich accused who put together, cobbled together a dream team to defend him. So I think death penalty being fallible and final, there are too many possibilities of errors, and we should not risk these, at least not the mandatory death penalty.
Can I also add, as a practitioner that we hear from courts, from judges, it's often that we hear, oh, we're sorry, we sympathize with your client and with the accused, but we can't allow the application because it will open a floodgate. So it's quite frustrating, the threshold for review applications, especially for death penalty cases, should be studied and reflected and considered in a way that it should not be purely on the basis of floodgates, because it's lives that we're talking about and they have no other options than just going through the death penalty. So I think we have to be more considerate, and judges to be more considerate in cases where it involves lives, because really there's no other way to go about it at the end of the day, more moving forward than execution. You can't simply exonerate a person after they have been executed. That's not fair for the legal system to then serve the masses.
Do you think that we will see Malaysia abolishing the mandatory death penalty? I mean, are you guys hopeful that that is something?
Yes.
That, oh, okay.
Hopeful.
I think that's probably on the cards. But it's just that the government has appointed a committee, and I support that. I support discussion before decision, I think, is the sine qua non, the basic requirement of democracy. But we have to admit that democratic procedures are always slow. So there's a delay. But I'm quite sure that the mandatory nature will go. However, the committee has faced a lot of objections. Many people are saying, and Sherry may want to add to that, many people are saying, so you want to let these criminals go free. Mm. No one is saying that they should go free. They could be sentenced to imprisonment for life, which means their natural life. Or they could be sentenced to life imprisonment, which is 30 years. They could be given strokes of the rotan. So no one is saying they should go free, but it's just that the mandatory nature should go away. As to the issue many people are raising, and I also raised it earlier, that some people say retribution is justified. Mm-hmm. I have something to say about that. I think the quality of a civilization is judged as much by how we honor our heroes as how we treat the worst in our midst. That's how civilization should be judged. Earlier in human history, the primary purpose of criminal punishment was to exact revenge, to seek retribution, to create deterrence. Now, criminology, the field of criminology, has broadened its shores to encompass such aims as reform, rehabilitation. People are asking this question. You know, it's an interesting question. Everyone says the purpose of death penalty is to deter others.
That's right.
Some people are saying, wait a minute, this is unjust. Why should one human being be made a guinea pig to prevent others from committing the crime? Don't instrumentalize a human being for the purpose of preventing other human beings. So some people are saying deterrence is immoral.
Interesting.
In the sense that you are using one human being as a guinea pig, as an instrument to prevent others. If you're talking about retribution, maybe there is some moral justification of that, but not deterrence. We now view crime and punishment not just in a historical or religious way. We don't look at them, at crime and punishment, only with the lens of history or religion. But more broadly, we view things functionally. We collect social data, and I think you were quoting some social data. We ask, does the punishment work? Does it deter? And you know,
there's no statistics.
There is no convincing evidence that death penalty has stopped
or decreased
drug offenses or murders.
Yes.
There is no convincing penalty. So the idea, the functional functionalism, I think we are looking at things functionally. We look at social data. We ask, does the punishment work? Are minorities, the poor, the usual recipients of the death penalty?
Yes.
We ask, in an age of human rights, is it justifiable to use cruel and oppressive punishments to allow our primordial instincts for violence to color our judgment? So the idea is we must take revenge. Yes, I know in earlier days that used to be, the normal thing in society. But I think these days we have more ideas. We want to reform. We want to rehabilitate. So I wish to say this, that we are quite aware of public opinion on this issue is divided. But at the same time, with all due respect, leaders of substance cannot follow opinion polls on the great issues of the times. They must mold opinion, not with guns or dollars or position, but with the power of their souls.
Absolutely. Agree. When we condemn the act of a person being killed, taking life of a person, but we should also condemn a violation of another person's right of life by act of state-sanctioned killing. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Legalized murder.
Yes, legalized murder by the state.
Yeah, so, if life is sacred, then it doesn't become less sacred just because a rule permits it, permits life to be taken. Yes.
Yeah, we shouldn't sanitize vengeance, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking to Emeritus Professor Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, a professor of constitutional law at the University of Malaya, and Sherry Razak Dali, who is a lawyer and a filmmaker, and she's also the co-director of Menunggu Masa. And again, that film is available online.
Yes.
Did you say?
Yes. You can Google it.
Okay, we'll just Google it, and you can find out, you know, how flawed our judicial system can be.
Yes.
Especially for those who are in the underprivileged category. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn interviews, you can search for the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. This has been Law and Behold on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.